From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today, Write the Book has two segments. First, an interview from the archives with author and librarian Josh Hanegarna, whose memoir, The World's Strongest Librarian, was published in 2013 by Gotham. And after that, you'll hear the first of a series of Write the Book chats with the owner of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Claire Benedict. Once again, we spoke in 2013, so her book suggestions were new at the time, but they're still great suggestions, and it's fun to hear what she was thinking at the time. Josh Hanegarna couldn't be invisible if he tried. Although he wouldn't officially be diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome until his freshman year of high school, Josh was 6 years old and on stage in a school Thanksgiving play when he first began exhibiting symptoms. By the time he was 20, the young Mormon had reached his towering adult height of 6'7", when, while serving on a mission for the Church of Latter-day Saints, his Tourette's tics escalated to nightmarish levels. Determined to conquer his affliction, Josh underwent everything from quack remedies to lethargy-inducing drug regimens to Botox injections that paralyzed his vocal cords and left him voiceless for 3 years. Undeterred, Josh persevered to marry and earn a degree in library science. At last, an eccentric autistic strongman and former Air Force tech sergeant and guard at an Iraqi prison taught Josh how to throttle his tics into submission through strength training. Today, Josh is a librarian in the main branch of Salt Lake City's public library and founder of a popular blog about books and weightlifting, and the proud father of 4-year-old Max, who has already started to show his own symptoms of Tourette's. The World's Strongest Librarian illuminates the mysteries of this little understood disorder, as well as the very different worlds of strongman training and modern libraries. Josh Hanegarna first experienced symptoms of Tourette's as a young boy in school and soon came to see it as another entity within himself, almost like a sentient being controlling him. He started calling this entity Misty for Miss Tourette's. I began our interview by asking him to talk about this sense that Tourette's was a being outside of himself.
Yeah, that kind of started just as an accident. I remember, excuse me, I remember telling my mom one day, I think it was in junior high, this is way too hard. I've got to stay home from school. You know, like I'm too embarrassed.
Yeah.
And she said, no, you can't let this thing make your decisions for you. And that was the first time I remember actually thinking of it as if it was this real other thing. And before too long, I mean, I was calling it Miss Tourette's, and that kind of changed into Miss T. And I think part of that is just, I mean, I was a young boy hitting puberty, and I probably subconsciously decided if somebody's going to be following me around, it might as well be a girl. And then, you know, before too long, Miss T had red hair and green eyes and was quite visually specific.
Yeah.
But honestly, it was more like an earworm at that point, just something I got stuck in my head. But I am very competitive, and at times it definitely has helped to be able to pretend I'm actually fighting against something real instead of this mess of chemicals that has no idea I exist.
Right, yeah. I also wondered if it was also helpful to kind of create this sort of, a villain, in a way, to deal with it.
Kind of. I mean, it makes it easier to root for someone if they're actually working against someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it works in a lot of different ways. Did you ever read The Ruins by Scott Smith by any chance?
No, I haven't, no.
It's a really wonderful horror book, but the bad guy kind of does turn out to be this evil plant.
Okay.
And a lot of people are really annoyed by that, and I didn't hate it. I loved the book. But I also remember thinking, it's kind of hard to root against a plant.
It is.
You know, in the same way that, like, you can really throw in against a James Bond type villain.
Exactly, right. Actually, though, it's funny, when I read books like horror books or thrillers, sometimes it's
it's easier to be frightened by the thing you don't know what it is. And then, like, I remember this with Stephen King's It, which you actually talk about in this book. It became a little less scary once I knew exactly what was going on. Does that?
Yeah, I agree. This is one thing I liked about H.P. Lovecraft, is he would say things like, "And if you could have seen how horrible it was, you would have gone insane." And he'd never try to explain, "And here's what it looked like."
The horror of it, right.
Because it would obviously fail to drive you insane, and then you're kind of let down.
Yeah, absolutely. You mention in the books that there's a difference between what you have experienced and the Hollywood version of Tourette's syndrome. So I wondered if you could talk about the difference of that between those.
Sure. And it all does come from the same place, but if a lot of people have heard of Tourette's, it is generally the condition where somebody is yelling obscenities uncontrollably.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very real condition. It's called coprolalia. It can actually exist outside of Tourette's, but even in extreme cases of Tourette's like mine, it's very rare. So I do a lot of yelling and thrashing around, but for some reason, it's always just been random sounds, never specific words.
Yeah.
But I've seen people who have it, and it's very real, and it's astonishing to see it up close, and it's real, and you can get a lot more comic mileage out of something like that than something like the things you would see me do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I get it, and I don't take it personally, but at this point, I also have an adult's perspective on it, and when I travel and I meet kids with Tourette's, you know, they're not always able to just laugh it off. It feels more personal to them, but
sure,
they're at a point where, you know, they don't want to be mocked, and people's approval matters to them much more than most adults will experience.
Yeah. Now speaking to you now, Josh, I'm not hearing any verbal tics. Are those pretty well under control for you these days? And also, I was curious if the book tour has made it worse.
At age 35, I am far worse than I've ever been.
Really?
During the darkest times I write about in the book.
Yeah.
One of the reasons, however good of a speaker I am, it is because I've had so much practice, because when I talk, I don't have tics generally.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of my first interviews in New York was on the phone, and the interviewer kept saying, "I'm sorry, Josh, do you hear that clicking noise?" Because I was going... And I let it go a couple of times before I said, "It's not your phone, it's me."
Yeah.
And then we laughed about it. The book tour certainly has made some things worse, but it's more the elements of it. If I was going to give you a list of reliable triggers, it would have travel, hotels, airplanes, fatigue, being the center of attention, having my picture taken, bright lights, you know, and on and on and on.
Interesting.
It would look almost exactly like a book tour.
Yeah.
So physically I'm way worse now. Mentally I'm far better than I've ever been. Some of that has just been getting older, I think.
Sure. I would think it would be so hard to be a kid, and particularly maybe a teenager at a certain age, going through this on top of everything else that teenagers have to go through. It just seems like it would make you such a target.
You know, it can, and it did occasionally, but I don't really feel like I got picked on more than any other kids.
Yeah.
Well, maybe more than some, and I also probably wasn't always the nicest kid. I'm sure I did my own share of being crueler than I should have been to other kids, because I mean, I think every kid does somehow. But it did make it so I couldn't really hide. For people who didn't like me, they always had a reason to focus on me.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't really just fade into the background and not be noticed.
Right. Well, even if you didn't have Tourette's, you're a very large person.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I looked dumb. I had a terrible haircut, and I was tall and gawky. I mean, you could have, if you were mean, you could have taken your pick of several things to focus on, some of which were my fault and my poor fashion choices.
Yeah. I wondered, do you think growing up in a Mormon community made a difference to the way that you were treated and supported as a person with Tourette's syndrome?
I don't think so. I mean,
no.
It's easy to you know, you get in a group of 100 Mormons or any religious people in general, I'd say, and most of those people are probably going to be genuinely kind and concerned.
Yeah.
But I also think most people, you're going to find more nice people than you are mean people in any sample group, you know? So a lot of people say, how do people generally react to you? Like, do they tell you to shut up? And say, you know, when people do react, it's so much more common that someone says, are you okay?
Mm.
Hey, what's your problem? So I grew up around very nice people, you know, and maybe like having my circle have been a bunch of really religious Mormons helped with that, but I wouldn't have necessarily felt like if it had been any other group, you know, I wouldn't have had as much support.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so in the book you talk about after a lot of medications and failed attempts to find treatment, your dad took you to the gym to start lifting weights. And in the book you say, what a fascinating, bizarre turnaround. I was choosing to do something so difficult and painful that my symptoms didn't seem as bad. So I wondered if we could talk about, you know, why you think that was.
Well, at the time, I mean, a couple things happened with the weightlifting. My dad took me to the gym largely because, if nothing else, I wanted to be able to put back some of the weight on that I had lost.
Right. Your mission.
Yeah, yeah. And so a couple things happened in the gym. It gave me a brief period every day where I felt like I had control of my body.
Yeah.
But again, then it did kind of become competitive because my physical tics were so painful, but I couldn't control them. And I'm not saying this is rational in any way, but I took great pride in being able to go to the gym and absolutely beat on myself and, you know, in these workouts that were so incredibly painful that everything else did seem much easier. Now, that is no longer the way I approach the problem, but it is got me through that time, and that was a time when I was a lot angrier about everything that was happening and a lot more frightened because there were a lot more unknowns, and I really didn't think it would ever get better.
Yeah.
So that was the start of it, just trying to push back at something, and I don't know, a therapist could probably read a lot more into it, because I hear myself saying things like, you know, and I would punish myself for, you know, with these workouts and blah blah blah. And so I wouldn't read too much into it, but I can see how other people might.
Yeah.
Honestly, it just felt like a way to hit back, even though I couldn't hit back at anything real.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, specifically about the layout of the book, I really loved how you used the Dewey Decimal headings in subjects at the start of each chapter, and you put the numbers next to them. I loved that because it was such a familiar labeling system to anyone who's ever spent time in the library, which, you know, I love the library, so. how did that come to you to do that?
It was kind of lucky. It did just kind of pop up in my head. One of the challenges I had originally was what the publishers, what I think most people would tell you is interesting about the story is there are all of these kind of antagonistic storylines going on all at once, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The loud librarian, the librarian strongman, the ex Mormon who still has some faith, kind of. But all of these things all together are kind of recent developments, you know. I felt like if I had started with a typical autobiography of I was born and then this and then this, we wouldn't get to a lot of what I think a lot of people consider the really interesting stuff until the last 20 pages or so. Because all these things have only been present in the last few years. So what I tried to figure out, you know, every story, every place starts with a library story. And I thought, in these current day stories, that's where I can try to, you know, remind everybody that all these things are happening all at once.
Yeah.
Before backtracking into an appropriate point in the backstory. And the Dewey numbers, I mean, I started out thinking just by subject, what are kind of the subjects of this chapter? And then that just kind of popped up. It made sense to me because I do kind of catalog everything in that way.
Yeah.
So just lucky.
Yeah, wonderful. It's such a pleasure because, you know, you see all these books having interesting little things at the beginning. I remember Annie Proulx puts those knot tying tips at the beginning of each chapter in, what was that? Shipping News. Anyway, this was a fun one and very, wonderful for people who love libraries. Now, you mentioned that the beginning of each chapter has a library scene, and I was surprised in reading the book about how many library interactions are sort of contentious or stressful. I always think of librarians as just sort of helping people find information, but you're asking people not to sleep in the library, not to bring their dogs in, to please control their children. You had people hiding books on you and people who sort of attacked you for having religious books in nonfiction. It was amazing.
Now, again, most interactions are either positive or they're just kind of dull and not worth thinking about again.
Okay.
A lot of people have written to me and said things like, I had no idea libraries were like that. To which I will say, I don't think most libraries are.
Yeah.
Even the other five locations in my library system are probably much more like what you are picturing.
Yes.
If anything, I have understated what it is like to work in my public library in downtown Salt Lake on my floor.
Okay.
And I've heard from a lot of librarians who work there who said, you didn't go nearly far enough. So, you know, feel free to hold on to whatever image of libraries works for you, because if it's been your experience with libraries, it doesn't mean, I mean, you're right. But come visit me on level 3, you know, spend a week, and you'll definitely see a few of these stories. They're not the norm, but the best, most memorable stories are rarely the good ones.
Yeah, okay. Now there's a lot of humor in the book. It's you know, despite some pretty difficult material, the book has a lot of wonderfully funny and upbeat moments. And at one point your dad calls your humor a smokescreen. So I wondered if you think you became funny as a defense mechanism and how that might have helped.
I think that's always part of any humor.
Yeah.
I think a lot of what is funny actually comes from something sad.
Yeah.
But when I tried to think about this, my family, and I realized we communicate almost completely in jokes. It's just always been how it is.
Right, okay.
And I think it was Stephen Colbert who said, if you're laughing, it's hard to be scared by something. I also remember my dad saying to me, guys like us don't get to be devastatingly handsome, but the funny guy always has a shot. So that was always in my mind somewhere.
That's great.
You know, so that, it's just kind of always the way it's been. I do think you can burn yourself out on it, and I know that, I think it was Kurt Vonnegut or Mark Twain who discussed irony fatigue, and during the end of Mark Twain's career, you can see his writing becoming much darker. Because he'd been laughing at everything for so long, it just all seemed to kind of go out of him with some other things that were happening in his life.
Right.
So, yeah, I think a lot of it's self-defensive. I think the most dangerous people in the world are the humorless, and the people who simply couldn't laugh at themselves under any circumstances.
Mm.
So I hope my thinking on this will evolve with more time, but that's probably the least I can say about it right now.
Yeah, okay. All right. Now, you talk in The World's Strongest Librarian about a daily intensity quota that must be met when you're talking about your tics and your, you know, sort of involuntary movements. So can you explain anything about why there would be a daily intensity quota? And also, do you think that other people with Tourette's have the same sort of quota that goes on for them?
Yes, it seems to be the way it is with everybody I've talked to. I'll give you a quick example. On my flight to San Francisco, it was only about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But flying is miserable enough without having somebody, you know, yapping in your ear or barking the whole flight. So I can stifle it for a while if I need to. And so on this flight, I really ground down on it. And the urges are still there, and they get worse as you try to stifle them. And then when the driver, this wonderful media escort named David Galea, picked me up, we got in his car, and suddenly, boom, like I yelled, and I started really thrashing around. And this was the craziest response, but, like, he suddenly changed lanes really quickly and almost went into another car. And he said, sorry, sorry. And I laughed. I said, I'd be startled too, but I can't figure out why you changed lanes all of a sudden. And so we laughed about that all day. So another example, for me to be in the library, it's really important to me that I not interfere with anyone else's use of the space.
Mm-hmm.
So most people who see me have tics there, they see it, they don't hear it, because I try to make things more physical than vocal there. When I come home, it kind of blows, you know, when I'm at home, it's much more likely, these are the tics where I'm going to injure myself or actually get hurt or experience real pain from the tics.
Mm.
What you see and hear me do out in public is generally the compromise between what I actually need to do and what I feel like I can get away with and still be out in public.
Right, right.
But yeah, I mean, even a little boy named Stephen came to my thing in San Francisco, and he said the same thing. He said, I have to figure out a way to have like 1,000 small tics during the day so I don't have to have the big ones when I get home that scare me.
Yeah, I would think your book is going to be so helpful for kids like that are going through this. I mean, it's not very, is it a very common syndrome?
You know, I don't know. I have some relatives, and they all told me recently, we've always got at least one Tourette's kid in every grade.
Hmm.
So I don't know. Part of that might be awareness. There are different ideas about when to diagnose it or when it's even worth diagnosing, so it's possible we are just capable of diagnosing it more often now than we were. Every time a new edition of the DSM comes out, it's like 600 pages longer.
Yeah.
So I fully expect that by DSM-6, you'll have Tourette's, I'll have autism, we'll all be diagnosed with everything.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. I've heard everything from 1 in 100,000 people to 1 in 50,000, you know, and more extremes in both directions.
Yeah, okay. Do you mind if I read a paragraph from the book and then we can talk about it?
Of course not.
Okay, great. So you write, at lunch, many of the librarians lurched up to the staff room and fell onto chairs and couches with their books and magazines. Librarians, as a rule, move about as well as the Tin Man did before Dorothy brought him the oil can. Their heads often sit so far forward on their necks that they look like woodpeckers frozen in mid-peck. Their shoulders are rounded from answering the phone, typing, eating, and reading. Their hands at rest inevitably rotate into the typing position. They spend so much time looking down at computers and into books and talking down to people from their tall desks that it's become an unnatural effort to raise their eyes to make eye contact during conversation. You know, I'm sure some of this is an exaggeration to be a little bit funny, but I never thought about that before, but it is a job where your body is sort of frozen in these uncomfortable positions sometimes. Can we just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, anybody listening to this, what I'd encourage you to do is just substitute librarian for anyone who sits in a chair all day and types a lot.
Yeah, right.
We're always getting better at whatever we do, and based on our habits, that can be a reward or a punishment. So we are just, you know, the modern office worker is simply moving less than they might have in a different job, you know, or in a different time.
Mm-hmm.
So if your neck is always forward as you squint into a computer monitor, that's going to become your normal.
Right.
You start to become shaped like your chair and like your habits. That's kind of what it is. If you move less during the day than in the past, it's generally not a good thing for your body.
Mm.
And you start to, again, your tissue changes and you have a new normal that you get locked into. And when you see elderly people who, you see it a lot where the shoulders have been dragged forward and they're kind of hunched over. This is people who have not gotten enough movement in the opposite direction, like rowing things towards them with that pulling motion.
Mm-hmm.
And when you sit in a chair for too long without ever stretching the areas around your groin, your hip flexors shorten up. And one day, it's just, you're kind of trapped. And so that's pretty much it. It's just most people don't have a real awareness of how they sit and what it might be doing to them.
Right.
And I have to be aware of it because some of those things seem to actually make my tics worse.
Yeah.
And getting in as many positions as possible seems to help with the tics.
The other side of that is something that you mentioned in your book trailer. I watched the video, the book trailer video, and you say librarian is sort of like a state of mind. So getting away from the physical of the librarian, what did you mean by librarian is a state of mind, if you remember?
Well, I feel like I've been a professional librarian for 7 years, and I've been like an honorary librarian for about 35, I'd say.
Okay.
And I'm 35 years old. You just, you know, you're kind, and I see it in the same kids that come in, and they don't know that the library's not cool yet. It's just people who love stories, people who love books. I decided long ago that if the blog ever got popular enough, I would just change the URL to worldsstrongestlibrarians.com, and everybody who read it could just be a librarian. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah.
I do library work, but I think in stories and questions, and that's really all it comes down to for me.
Yeah.
If you ask a lot of questions and you're curious about things and you like people, you'd make a good librarian.
Okay. Now, given the importance of books and libraries in your life since you were little, how was it to hold this book in your hands for the first time?
Really weird. I was surprised at how moved I was.
Yeah.
I don't just sit around and cry with every new bit of good news, but I took the book out. I started crying. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
It took a long time to get here, and it's been overwhelming.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Pretty easy to stay humble when you're always grateful.
Now, have you ever had the opportunity to check it out to a library patron?
Not yet. I did go down one day, and we have a cart called a shelf called the Lucky Shelf. These are books that are not in the catalog, so they can't be reserved. So
okay.
If you come and you see one there, like it might be my book. It might be the new Claire Massoud book. It's a new book, generally, that other people are waiting for.
Yes.
I did one day come down, and there were five of those on the shelf. And when I came back down an hour later, they were all gone.
Oh, cool.
So I don't work in speculation. I work up in the nonfiction department, so I don't check books out for people anymore.
Yeah.
I've had about 20 people come up with their books to get them signed.
Oh.
At the front desk, and that's wonderful.
That's great. You have to look in the front cover and make sure they're not library books first.
I think.
Let's see. Okay, so I just have one last question for you, Josh, and that is, do you have any advice for people who are maybe suffering from a neurological syndrome, or really any syndrome or disease process, who are trying to write about it?
Oh, you know what? That's a great question. Here's what I'll say. When you write about yourself or your own story,
yeah,
you're probably going to be writing about other people in your life. And you start asking questions like, is this going to embarrass anybody? How would somebody else feel about this? Is this too raw? Am I being too negative? Just whatever. I will say, I think those are all appropriate questions, but not for the first draft.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So for me, when I started asking these questions, I realized if I start trying to answer them all now and checking in with everybody to see if things are okay first, I'm never going to get anything done. So I just wrote and wrote and wrote. I put in anything that I thought might be relevant, knowing full well that most of it would not be and most of it wouldn't be good. And then on my second draft, once I had made the gigantic mess and told myself what I thought the story might be, that is when I started checking in with my mom or my wife and saying, does this feel right? Is this how you remember it? Are you uncomfortable about any of this? But again, tell yourself the story first, because nobody else is going to make you write it. And, you know, if you start getting hung up on how other people will react, you're pretending you have readers you don't have yet.
Right.
Yeah, that can be an easy, you know, I don't say that to be discouraging. It's just the reality. You have to care first enough to write it.
Yeah.
You care too much about these other people who might read it later, your chances of finishing it, I think, are that they go down.
I would think, too, that another truth about what you just said is that once you put it in writing in a first draft, it sort of solidifies it. And probably makes it a little bit harder for you to remember it differently. So I would think you have to get your own version down first.
I think it was Stephen King in his book on writing that said, On the first draft, tell yourself the story. On the second draft, take out everything that's not the story.
Okay, that's great.
And it's not always easy, but it makes a lot of sense to me, and sometimes it really helps me look at it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was a wonderful interview. I really appreciate your time, Josh. The book, again, is The World's Strongest Librarian, published by Gotham Books, Josh Hanagarny. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It was a lot of fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Josh Hanagarna. You can learn more about his work at his websites, joshhanagarna.com and worldstrongestlibrarian.com. In the next part of the show, I play an interview from the archives with Claire Benedict, who's the owner of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. Claire and I do talk every once in a while, although it's been a while, and we need to do so again. But with COVID, everything's been crazy. But anyway, we do talk about books that are newly out in the world. These were books that she suggested in 2013, but I thought it would be kind of fun to listen in and see what she was saying back then. Those are still great books to look into. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Bear Pond Books has been in downtown Montpelier for 40 years. It's our 40th birthday this summer.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
It's a long time for a store in general, and exciting for bookstores in this day and age, too, to have that kind of staying power.
Yeah.
So we'll be celebrating. we used to be across the street where Rivendell Books now is, and after the flood in the 90s, moved to its present location right at the corner of State and Main. And we've been going strong ever since. It's a great store with general interest. We have a really big children's room on our second floor, and we are very strong on cookbooks and history, fiction, and Vermont titles, I'd say, which is a lot of things to be strong on. Which is, so
yeah.
We're general interest is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But we are strong in those particular topics.
You guys don't have any sort of little niche sideline, right? Like there's no cafe, no art gallery. It's all books.
No, no. We do have sidelines. We do have some non-book items in the store, but I wouldn't say there's a real niche thing like a cafe.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes people ask us, why don't you put a cafe in? But, you know, if you've been to Montpelier, you know there's like coffee shops on every corner.
Yeah.
So we don't really need another cafe.
Right, and it sounds like you don't need a cafe to run your business, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, and we're not really that interested in running a cafe. It's just not our thing. We're into books.
Yeah.
So we try to stick to that. And, you know, we've branched out in recent years. We have an e-commerce site now, so you can order books online from the comfort of your home in your pajamas if you want and stuff. You know, we're trying to respond to realistically to the modern work, you know, marketplace. But we are really, what we do best is the bricks and mortar, hand selling, talking to customers. And so that's what we've stayed focused on.
Okay. Now, is Rivendell owned by the same people?
Yes.
And that's Rivendell, a used bookstore, right?
Rivendell is the almost entirely used bookstore. They have some new books. My husband, Rob Casso, and I own both of the stores.
Oh, okay.
He runs Rivendell, and I run Bear Pond.
Oh, okay.
We've owned Rivendell since 2002, and we bought Bear Pond from its original owners in 2006.
Okay. Oh,
so
great.
We kind of have, you know, we're very close to each other. You know, we could stand in our doorways and wave to each other.
but it would take you a half an hour to cross that street to actually get to each other.
Oh, come on. It's not that, there's not that much traffic in Montpelier. it's kind of odd to, you know, own two businesses so close together, but it, they really serve different customers and different needs between the used and the new.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of worked out, and we're able to like refer customers to each other all the time.
Okay.
So
great.
It's kind of a nice symbiotic relationship.
And you do have a lot of events at Bear Pond. I know that, like readings and.
We do. We do readings on Tuesday night about twice a month is sometimes more, sometimes less, but on average twice a month we'll have readings. And we have we do a lot of local authors, but we do nationally known authors as well. For example, we have Sue Halpern coming in tonight. Mm-hmm. To different times of the year, the flavor of them changes, but you know, we've got a lot of cookbooks coming right now.
And yeah. Is Sue Halpern bringing her dog?
I would imagine she's bringing her dog, but I do not know for sure.
Okay, because her dog. Her new book is about the dog, right? It's about,
yeah, her book, yeah, is about the dog. It's called A Dog Walked Into a Nursing Home, and it's about how she, I guess she needed a hobby, and she has this wonderful dog, and the two of them trained to be service animals.
Oh.
And she started going to a nursing home and volunteering, and has had this wonderful experience both for her and for the people that she was visiting in the nursing home. And so she's written a book about it. It's really a wonderful story. So she'll be talking about that.
Okay. Well, as long as we're on books, I was going to go ahead and ask you what books you are recommending these days.
Well, my very, very favorite book right now is called The Woman Upstairs by Claire Massoud.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, once or twice during the year, I have a book that I love so much that I'm just forcing everybody I know to read it, and then some customers that I don't know very well. I try to force it on them too, but only because I love it so much. And right now, for me, that book is The Woman Upstairs by Claire Massoud. She is a beautiful writer. I've loved her books in the past, and this one I think might be even my favorite. It's a story about this a single woman. She's 37 years old. Her name is Nora. And she's an elementary school teacher, teaches third grade. She's the perfect unmarried woman upstairs.
Okay.
She's the person you can count on, the one who calls her father every day, the one who always brings a baked good to the proper to the proper event, the one who always gets her garbage out on time. But it's not really the life Nora expected to lead. She wanted to be an artist, and she's feeling frustrated. And she meets, she gets a new student in her class who's from another country. He's a little exotic, and she meets his mother, who is very exotic, and is also an artist. And they forge a relationship, and she meets the husband and the kid. And she loves the kid, and she's drawn deeply into this family that is much more interesting and artistic than she has ever been.
Okay.
And Nora's world is changed.
It sounds like she meets these people and is fascinated because they have everything she wants. Is that sort of underlying?
Well, you know, maybe there's some of that, but what's wonderful about this book is I give you a setup, and you can probably think of four
right.
different ways it's probably going to end,
yeah.
And it doesn't end any of those ways.
Oh, okay.
Is what I liked about it, is there's nothing expected happens here. But on the other hand, it's not a thriller with a huge climactic scene and, you know, crazy things happening either. It's very quiet, and it's calm, but it's incredibly powerful.
Right.
And that's where I think the beauty of Massoud's writing comes in, is that she can kind of take an ordinary situation, and by the end, you're just blown away by Nora, by the emotion that she experiences, by the passion that that she has in this book.
It reminds me, I think probably the title must refer to that book that came out, I think it came out in the 70s, about the mad women in the attic, and how women were often written about as being just sort of like shunted aside, mm-hmm. and having to be good and quiet. Is that
right? It's a bit of a, she's the good girl.
She's
always played the good girl role. And now she's pissed. and that too, you could say, well, I think I may have read that story before somewhere. And it's true, in that description, you have heard about the good girl who got tired of it before. But this is a refreshing, different look at it.
Okay.
So it's told quietly without high drama, but, and she doesn't have to resort to, plot twists or sensational climaxes, because her writing and her characters are so wonderfully written that she can do it without those contrivances.
Yeah,
One of the reviews I read about this book kind of summed it up for me. It said it was brilliant and terrifying.
Hmm.
And I loved it.
Okay. All right.
And the first person I recommended it to, called me a week later. Immediately, I just finished it. I have to talk to somebody about this.
Oh, wow.
So, thoroughly enjoyable.
Okay, that's excellent. All right, so what's next on the list?
There's a brand new bestseller out that just came out a week or two ago that people probably are hearing about. It's called And the Mountains Echoed by Khaled Hosseini.
Oh, right, sure.
Yeah, and he wrote The Kite Runner.
Yes.
So that's where people know about him, and almost everybody in the world read The Kite Runner, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Very popular book for a long time. So he has a new book out. It's called And the Mountains Echoed. It's hard to talk about his books without comparing to The Kite Runner.
Right.
But I think this one compares very favorably. I think I even liked it better than The Kite Runner. He is a great writer. He's just really a wonderful storyteller. And that came through in The Kite Runner. And this book kind of proves that it was not a one-hit wonder. He could do it again. But it's a completely different story. Both books delve deeply into Afghan culture, and he paints this exotic picture of Afghanistan, but he's still very realistic about the troubles there, and not everything is wonderful.
And my recollection obviously from his previous books is he's pretty good at educating his readers about the situations are going on.
You don't need to know all the Afghan history and the history of the uprisings and the politics to
right.
read this book. It's the politics. I mean, you can't write a book about Afghanistan present day without the political themes in the background, but it is not a very political book.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, things are going on and you hear about that, but it's not really about the politics. It's about family and family bonds, particularly sibling bonds.
Okay.
It starts out in the 1940s with this 10-year-old boy, Abdullah, and his 3-year-old sister, Pari. And they're very, very close. Their mother died in childbirth. So Abdullah is basically raising the 3-year-old himself. His father remarried. The new wife has no time for the children of the first marriage. They're very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're struggling. And the father makes a decision that separates Pari and Abdullah.
Mm.
And it's very wrenching for both of them. And it sets into motion actions and reactions that reverberate through their family and many families. It starts in the 40s and it comes right through the present day. Ultimately, you know, they go from this rural village in Afghanistan. The story goes to Kabul, Paris, California, Greece. It's really kind of an epic story, and a number of families are brought into the mix. And there's very strong sibling bonds,
and what I've read,
functional and sometimes not.
and I've read that it's in different voices. Each chapter is a different voice. Do they repeat?
Not strictly speaking, but it does. Oh. I think it's all told in third person.
Okay.
Actually. But it does skip around to telling stories of different people. Both Pari's story as she's growing up, Abdullah's story as he eventually leaves Afghanistan. A lot of people leave Afghanistan.
Mm, yeah.
But a lot of them come back too.
Okay.
I mean, they're driven out for political reasons and economic reasons, but a lot of them come back too. So it does give these different perspectives of different characters. Yeah.
And the movement through time, does it go back and forth, or is it sort of chronological? Or
no, it's pretty much chronological.
That one sounds great too. He's always so good. I actually really loved A Thousand Splendid Suns as well, although I think it kind of fell in the shadow of The Kite Runner because
a little
I was
bit.
So huge.
I don't think it quite measured up to The Kite Runner, but I think this one really does. He's just a great storyteller,
yeah.
And he clearly loves his native country, but he doesn't get too sentimental about it. You know, the sentiment is there, but he sees it realistically.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. So that's a couple of great suggestions. You want to talk about another one?
Okay. Let's see. Another new book. Our fairly new book is Flora by Gail Godwin.
Oh, yeah. She's wonderful.
she is wonderful. I haven't read her in a really long time. I think Evensong was probably what she's best known for. And she's written a new book that it's set in 1945 and narrated by a 10-year-old girl, another 10-year-old. Which is just a coincidence. I don't always read books about children. She's about this 10-year-old girl, Helen. It's the summer of 1945, and we know that the war is about to end. They don't quite know that yet. They live in North Carolina, basically on top of a mountain. And Helen's mother is dead. Oh, another 10-year-old with a dead mother.
Wow.
Look at this. I don't know where I'm going with this. I think this is just a coincidence. Her mother is dead. She's been being raised by her dad and her grandmother. And her grandmother just died.
Oh.
And her father decides to take the summer off to go help out at a job in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which he doesn't say what that's about, but we know that he's helping build a bomb. We're not sure if he knows that either, but that's an aside story because he leaves. So somebody has to take care of Helen. So they call in her 22-year-old cousin, Flora, who she doesn't really know. And she, so Helen and Flora are alone for the summer, and there's also a polio scare, so her father won't let them leave the house. So they're, like, really alone for the summer, just the two of them on this mountaintop.
Wow.
And so that's the setup.
What a very difficult narrative setup to give herself. I mean, Gail Godwin, I mean, that would be hard to write a book about two people in isolation on the top of a mountain.
Yeah. All they have is the grocery delivery boy.
Okay.
And he's important.
Okay.
Because that's all they have.
Yeah.
And he's also, so we have a lot of, Flora is a cousin who's also doesn't have, her parents are also dead and was staying with her aunt and uncle. So we have a lot of people with family but are a little bit rootless. They're unparented people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sadness. There's definitely a sadness about these characters.
And how about the child narration? Is that well done? Did you feel like...
Well, it's not first person.
Oh, okay.
So, which I think is really helpful because I don't love child narrated books, actually, even
okay.
though I just recommended two books with 10-year-old as me. Well, in End of Mountains Echoed, the 10-year-old is... He's only 10 for a very short period of the book.
Right. And it sounds like that's not first person either, is that
Yeah,
correct?
No, that's not first person either. So it's she's not, it's told from her point of view, but she is not the narrator.
All right.
This one.
Okay.
Which I think kind of helps because a child narrated book can be very tough.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's well done, but sometimes it's a little precious, so.
I often find it a little precious,
yeah.
a little too precious. But Helen is with smart little thing. She's pretty cynical about the world. So she's got a good attitude. You can handle her. She's not too sweet or anything. She's definitely not too sweet. That might be her problem. So anyway, Helen is, so Flora comes in. Flora is innocent and simple, and she's kind of emotionally fragile. She cries a lot, and Helen just can't stand that. Helen finds her weak, and it's pathetic that an adult works, lives this way, or is like this. And she starts to learn some things from Flora about her own mother, though, because Flora knew Helen's mother better than Helen ever knew her.
Oh.
And it turns out some of Helen's disdain and mean-spiritedness maybe comes from this mother that she's held up on a pedestal for so long, and maybe her mother wasn't so great either.
Oh, interesting. That's a really neat setup, actually.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a different... It doesn't go in the way you expect it to, really. But ultimately, the whole story is about regret, because it's told... Oh, here's why it works. It's told, really, by Helen as decades later as an adult. And
oh,
she's
okay.
looking back at this experience.
Oh, okay.
I forgot that part.
No,
and she's telling the events of this summer. And her relationship with Flora gets so strained that there's eventually a climactic scene that is... Helen has to live with for the rest of her life.
Oh, okay.
And she doesn't become a sweet, wonderful person afterwards. She becomes a person who's who's living with regret and remorse.
Okay.
So there's a definite sadness to the story. I mean, I wouldn't say it's not like you're sobbing all the way through it kind of sadness, but there's a melancholy throughout the story.
Okay. It's funny. It's reminding me, just from your description, it's reminding me a little bit of Ian McEwan. What was it? Which book was that about the war and the little girl who...
Atonement.
Atonement, yeah. There we
go. Yeah. Yeah, with that looking back.
Yeah.
At what their innocent little 10-year-old selves did, not really realizing the ramifications of their actions, potentially. And yeah, so it's again, it's kind of an ordinary story, but she tells it in a really extraordinary way.
Okay. All right,
it's
great.
Really, it's surprisingly good. I wasn't expecting it to be as good as it was. It was really good.
So I know that you had one last book that you were going to recommend.
Yes. There's a really interesting book by a new author, or first-time published novelist. His name is Christopher Jansma, and the book is called The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards. And it's a really fun book. It's smart and intelligent, and it's a great book for writers and readers. It's very creative, and it starts out by introducing us to the narrator, who is a college student and wants to be a writer more than anything. And in his freshman writing class is this wildly talented other student, Julian McCann, and they quickly befriend each other.
Okay.
And but they're rivals nonetheless, because they both want to write. And so they help each other, but there's this underlying rivalry. And Julian has a friend, Evelyn, who is beautiful and mysterious, and she's an actress. And so, of course, the narrator immediately falls in love with her, and she's completely unattainable. So the three of them have this ongoing relationship through the years. They, you know, finish college, they move on. But eventually, the tensions between the three of them is too much, and there's a falling out. But then none of this is what the book is really about. It's not about the three of them. It's not about their story. What it's about is it's about storytelling and the nature of truth and fiction.
Oh, wow.
And the narrator tells stories all through and the book that we're reading and accepting. But then you're never really sure what's true and what happened and what he's writing as a story and what he's telling you as a reader as truth. And it gets very meta in there about writing and about truth. And it made me think of the great Stephen Colbert word, truthiness.
Truthiness.
<You know? laughs> Because it's like, it is the truth. Or is it? But what is truth? And then you start asking those questions. But it's really fun. It's a funny book. It's quickly paced. It's very entertaining. It's really quite original. And it goes all over the place. It's New York City. It's in Sri Lanka. It's in Luxembourg. It's, you know, it's kind of this wild ride. It's unpredictable. And I don't know. I love picking up a novel and feeling like this is a fresh new thing that I've never seen anything like this. And so really good. If you love reading, if you're a writer, I think you'll have a good time with this one. It reminded me a little bit of years ago, John Colapinto wrote a book about the author.
Okay.
That was also like delving deep into the world of being a writer. And it reminded me a little bit of that. But now,
is it ever frustrating because you don't know what's going on, or does it always have a satisfaction cleverness?
You know all that you need to know.
Okay.
All the time.
Okay.
So it's not frustrating at all. It's not, you're not trying to puzzle it out. You're sitting back and enjoying the ride.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, that sounds really good.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
All right, that sounds great. And then now you mentioned a minute ago that maybe there was a paperback that you would recommend as well.
Yeah, I know a lot of people like paperbacks, like for their book groups or, you know, easy reading on the beach. And The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson came out in paperback a few months ago and just won a Pulitzer Prize, which is even a better recommendation than me.
And I think I read an interview with him where he was totally blown away by that, like completely didn't expect it, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I think he deserved it. I think it's really an amazing book. It's a novel. It's about North Korea. It's about this young boy who's, grows up in North Korea. It's just this totally wild story about a completely wild place. And it's a really good read, and I highly recommend it for a book group. Lots to discuss.
Okay.
My book group actually read it, and it was one of our best discussions.
Oh, okay. That's great. So The Orphan Master's Son.
Yes.
Well, wonderful. Well, Claire, I want to thank you so much for speaking to me about books, and hopefully we can do this sort of semi-regularly.
That would be great. This is fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Claire Benedict from 2013. We've had a number of chats like that since then, and you can find them all on the podcast site. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write about a tool or machine that is being used in a way that was not originally how it was intended. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. So here we are, still living with this pandemic. I hope that you're able to stay safe and well, and that whatever else you're doing, you're able to read and write. I hope that you're able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. And for all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Next week on Write the Book, my guest will be the author Ken Follett. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.